beware, spoiler phobes. You've regressed into a storm of spoilers.
Something is coming. Something hungry for blood. A shadow grows on the wall.
This week, our podcast moves beyond adaptation to general nostalgia to cover Netflix's Stranger Things, the movie Pete's Dragon, and Brian K. Vaughan's Paper Girls. This discussion will certainly include all 8 episodes of Stranger Things, but can and will expand to talk about the current wave of 1980s specific nostalgia. We're not criticizing, we are reliving our childhoods. Remember, friends don't lie.
That sound. Ooh. Ooh. That came from something else.
Hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers off-season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I was born in the year of our Lord, 1984.
My name is Joanna Robinson. I was born in 1981.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I was born exactly 1 month, almost to the day, after the events of Netflix's Stranger Things.
Oh, we are, of course, going to 1983.
1983, okay.
1983. Things, which apparently we all watched to varying degrees of nitpicking, fact-checking. I will, of course, be bringing my nerdy predictions of what season 2 could come based on the series, but we're also going to steep ourselves deep in nostalgia for the 80s. These two guys saw Pete's Dragon. One of my family dogs died this week, so thought maybe don't see Pete's Dragon. Maybe not do that to myself. But you guys are going to fill me in a little bit on that. That's, of course, a remake of a movie from our childhoods as well. But before all of that, we have to do our reviews, which I hear are not all positive this week, Joanna.
Oh my God, for once, someone came through and gave us a terrible review. No. This is from KG777-818-373-829. The review is titled, 1 star. Not bad, but Joanna ruins it with her hypocritical PC social justice warrior stuff. That's it. Okay, and the other one star is not knowledgeable, not funny, 1 star by Garland Terrell, 157. And this Terrell wrote, would recommend any other podcast host no less than your average Redditor. So that's a sick burn from the Terrell family there.
Sick burn.
That's like a wildfire burn from the Terrells. But we do have a couple positive reviews. This one's 5 stars, titled From a Student of Kai, titled Wit, Wisdom, and a Hint of Smugness, Smiley Face. I am a student of Ki, or Kai, and I have read all the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. This is one of my favorite podcasts because A, book smugness is highly underrated, and B, the knowledge, sass, and energy given by all the hosts is second to none. I wait breathlessly each week to hear what else is going to come out of the Citadel of Crazy Town. I have been a fan of Joanna and Dave since Republic City Dispatch. Their enthusiasm and folksy charm is infectious and soothing. I also share Joanna's SJW status and her disdain for everything Zack Snyder. Anyway, I'm grateful for this podcast to be introduced to Neil Miller. I love the way that he eagerly embraces his crackpotitude and may have single-handedly built one of the most of the aforementioned Citadel. This is the best podcast for the uber fan of Game of Thrones and now with the off-season tour, pop culture in general. Speaking of the off-season tour, I have 2 suggested destinations. 1, Avatar, The Last Airbender, and or 2, Vertigo's Hellblazer series. So, this is a nice mixed bag of reviews. Thank you guys so much. Please continue leaving reviews. And yeah, it's a good place to drop a recommendation or a request for where we are going to go next on our pop culture tour.
The Avatar episode would be a 5-person podcast. It would.
We'd have to get Devendra and Patches on.
Everybody would be so happy. It'd be like we did the movie. You weren't there when we did the movie commentary, but
no.
That was like all getting together for a singular podcast feat and pulling it off. And, I think also getting the slam M. Night Shyamalan.
That'd be a great one if I take a vacation at any point in the year.
No, it's come a, on, I mean, Neil. It's watch a pretty an entire animated series.
It's a pretty quick watch. It's only like, oh, what, three fair. Seasons, and they're 30-minute episodes, and they're not even like a full season. But yeah, Neil's got plenty to do. But if you get to it, I mean, there's also comic books.
I saw that movie. It was bad.
Sure was. Anyway, the other thing is, I just don't want to get the name wrong, so I'm Googling it. I've been getting a lot of name wrong on podcasts recently. It's Michael DiMartino, right? Who's one of the creators? Yes. He has written a new book, which I've read. So that's coming out soon. So yeah.
Cool.
Anyway,
keep those suggestions.
I'm done with my
coming.
Section. Yeah.
Yes, as Joanna was alluding to, and as one of our reviewers alluded to, we began as a humble Game of Thrones podcast, and we like to check in with any news around Game of Thrones. Neil, what happened this week at Game of Thrones?
Well, not a lot of news per se, but there were a number of interviews with some of the principal cast about season 6 and their characters and their future, and Joanna read them all. I did not. But I think the key takeaway that I got from the summary off air was that Kit Harington agrees with Joanna and I think us that it was weird that Jon Snow came back totally normal, and he seems to be just as tortured by the whole season 6 Jon Snow coming back thing as the rest of us were, which is great to see. It's a real humanizing moment for Kit Harington.
So one of my favorite parts of the wrap did like a big splashy spread for Kit and Amelia, and then a slightly less splashy spread for Lena Headey. But Amelia Clark's comes with a video where they ask her to speak in Dothraki, and she says she can't because the phrases she most recently memorized, if she said them, would be spoilers, because someone she was sure out there would speak Dothraki and translate them and figure out what some of her lines for season 7 were. So she refused to speak any Dothraki. I feel like she's learned, because last season she was the first one who was like, maybe Kit's coming back. And I feel like she probably got her wrist slapped a little bit for that. So she's being very cautious. And then Lena Headey said something about that final scene. I think we had talked a little bit about the ambiguity of looks between Sansa and Littlefinger, and then Cersei and Jaime. And she said the look that she gave Jaime, as far as she was playing it, was a fuck you, because he doesn't look completely overjoyed to see her on the throne. And she is basically taking nothing but unconditional support from the people in her life these days. So she called their relationship completely toxic. So we're going to see how that plays out next season. But she's basically like, without her kids, she's like has no humanity left, and she's got no one. She's surrounded by yes men. She's got no one telling her no anymore. So yeah, that's dangerous. And I got a weird sinking feeling reading that. And sort of based on some stuff that Sophie Turner said recently about I don't know what we can expect from her and Littlefinger and machinations next season. I'm putting Sansa on my death watch for season 7.
Ooh.
Pretty high. I feel like she's going to ally herself with Littlefinger. Jon Snow, as we know, is like bulletproof now. And then that's going to be her undoing next season. Because I don't think she's got a big role to play in the finale. So getting her out of the way next season might be something to do.
Do we already have Jaime on our death watch for season 7?
I think Dave's been stumping for Cersei to be on
that's
Death
right.
Watch, right?
And I'm still with it. Surrounded by yes men is a perfect way to tumble from the highest heights.
But I think it can't be both, or maybe tragically it is both of them. But I feel like we thought maybe Jaime would kill Cersei next season.
I'm down for that, because then you got to force the Brienne, Jaime. Things we talked about on previous podcast episodes. you can find at findingintheworm.com/gotspoilers.
I didn't mean to spend too much time on Game of Thrones. I just thought I'm thirsty for news. The last thing I'll say is that Sophie Turner, for her new film she's doing, she got a bunch of fake tattoos painted on her, and one of them on her bicep is a massive dire wolf. It's just a wolf, but it's a massive wolf on her arm. And so a bunch of people are like, oh my God, did she get a Game of Thrones tattoo? No, it's for a role, but it looks pretty great. So check that out on her Instagram.
Yeah, check it out.
Vital Game of Thrones information from yours truly. All right,
we watch everyone's Instagram, so you don't have to here on Storm of Spoilers. This week, however, is not about Game of Thrones. It is, I think this week and next week is going to test the boundaries of our little off-season tour, in the sense that these are not going to be straight adaptation weeks like we usually do. We usually talk about it on our show. But we are going to talk about specific pop culture, and I think we're going to be able to rotate around not only the 8 episodes of Netflix's Stranger Things and what kind of feels like the inevitable season 2 that is hinted at, but the idea of sort of using nostalgia for either a period as a storytelling device. Either a period, I guess, or like a style. I'm
a
sure.
Pastiche.
A pastiche, sure.
Yeah.
Of course, Stranger Things is the story of a boy named Will Byers who is sucked into another dimension. And while searching for him, his friends happened across a psychic girl named Eleven, who's on the run from a Matthew Modine villain scientist, and some teenagers who are having sort of a Nightmare on Elm Street-ish fight amongst themselves, who also get sucked into this weird nexus of a whole other dimension and some monsters. I'm assuming if you're listening to this episode, you've seen Stranger Things, so I don't need to go too far into detail of what actually happened. I guess as a way to start, I was an early adopter on Stranger Things, kind of knew it was coming. As soon as I like got a peek at what it was going to feel like, I knew that when it dropped on Netflix, I had to binge it. And binge it I did. And was, I guess, before the whole it got really big amongst everybody, and there was like a little bit of reverse hype on the hating of Stranger Things. So when I mainlined Stranger Things, it was all positivity. And the second my friends were able to like finish it, I wanted to like sit down and talk to them about it. I wrote an article for Thrillist.com about questions I had, and I was like sitting down with like one of my friends, and she's like, "I found this article," and like took a while before reading it before I realized it was like you. So I was like fully engaged with Stranger Things as I was like pitching it to people as a Steven Spielberg meets Stephen King sort of short burst. How did you guys happen across this series? Neil first, Joanna.
Oh,
what? Wow. Jesus.
Cracking the whip this week.
Yes.
I actually, you know, it's funny because there was a lot of chatter about the trailer before. This was, a couple months ago. And I just never got around to watching the trailer. I just knew that it was the Netflix show that was very much, you know, I saw the poster and I was like, oh, okay. So it's got like an E.T. vibe and it's got Winona Ryder. And that's really all I knew until Netflix sent out their screeners, which I think was like a week or two before the show came out. And even then, I still didn't watch it. Gave the link to one of my writers and he watched it and he's like, oh my God, you have to watch this like right now. And so I finally sat down and watched the screeners, and I just knew. I mean, Stranger Things is one of those shows where you know about 5 minutes in, by the time it hits the credits in the first episode, whether or not you're in for the show or, I guess, out for the show. I haven't really met too many people that are out for the show quite yet. Mostly, a lot of the backlash at this point seems from the normal contrarian sources out there who are just like, oh, there's something that people love and I can get a little attention by not liking it. Okay, cool.
Okay.
But it feels like a lot of the people who are on it early, like you said, Dave, a lot of positivity. And it really is one of those shows that really grabs you first, like really grabs you nice and quickly, which is great. So yeah, that's where I was.
Now, Joanna.
Thank you. I also requested the screeners from Netflix, and I watched the first episode, and I loved it. I think I labored over this, like, overcooked tweet that was about, like, watch Stranger Things on a sweaty summer night with a popsicle and, like, you know, like, whatever. Like, because that's what it just gave me. It, you know, we're here to talk about nostalgia. It hit me pretty hard with, like, a summer feeling and an 80s feeling. And then when I put that on Twitter, our friend of the pod, Matt Patches, and the lovely Kate Arthur from BuzzFeed both came back at me immediately saying I was dumb and wrong for my opinion.
Oh, and I should amend my comments to say that those two were like the early. I remember that. Those two didn't like it early. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. I'm talking about it, people who came like weeks later. So,
I know neither Neil or I are accusing Kate or Patches of being like the contrarian type who just like to hate on things to get attention. Certainly not. Neither of them. But they didn't like the show and they had seen more episodes than I had. And I've been burned by a bunch of shows before that had like a really promising first episode, like London Spy, and then just went like seriously downhill. And I was just sort of like, I don't want to get burned again. So I put my screeners away and didn't watch it. But then Neil was like talking it up on the first weekend it was out. And I was like, oh, you know what? I trust Neil. I will watch the rest. And so I binged the rest that weekend. So I think we all had knocked it out within the first weekend. And I don't think I'm quite as positive as both of you guys. I am mostly positive, but I also understand some of the critiques that are about, that have to do with like originality. Which I think Stranger Things could use a little bit more of. You know, you mentioned the word pastiche. I get a little concerned when we see these like obvious pop culture retreads. Like there's so much of E.T. in this, just like there's so much of Fight Club and Mr. Robot. When I would much rather see something, you know, that's very much his own thing. And I don't think Stranger Things quite shook off the things it was referencing to firmly enough establish itself, like unlike Freaks and Geeks, which is set in a similar time period, but is very much his own thing and not leaning so heavily on the pop culture of that era. You know, they both have different intentions, obviously. This is not a one-to-one comparison, but that would be my criticism of Stranger Things. That being said, I quite liked it. I'm intrigued for season two. I agree with a certain Entertainment Weekly writer who sometimes we do not agree with, a piece he wrote today that I clicked on before I knew he wrote it, that I agree with, that maybe Stranger Things would be stronger as an anthology. But that's clearly not the direction they want to go in. They want to continue on with 11 and Winona Ryder and the rest. And, you know, I'm sure Dave has some thoughts about season two, but, I kind of like the idea of this supernatural event happening to this group and then moving on to something else rather than crazy supernatural things keep happening to this one town. Do you know? So we'll see.
Right. Well, originally they were thinking about doing a whole different like anthology thing or jumping forward in time and doing more of like a It homage and taking the child characters later in life when they would maybe encounter 11 again. But they've been encouraged since casting, you know, these kids by, I guess, Netflix and other producers, the Duffer Brothers, who are created it. Have been encouraged to do a second season that sort of picks up here. So what they have to go off of, from what I could tell based on interviews they've given, is they have a 30-page story document about what the Upside Down is. And apparently also in that story document, it explains why there's like only one monster. And they make vague hints that maybe the Upside Down was created somehow. So there's like an underlying mythology that's a story document. 30 pages is about average for those sorts of things. If you're doing like a television show in terms of stuff that you're going to have to, you know, jump from season to season. But I think there's a lot of interesting hints about, you know, the fact that there's only one monster or that the portal doesn't get closed at the end of the series, that means that this could go in a completely different direction or not a completely different direction, but a slightly different direction, and maybe play more off like sci-fi elements than horror elements, or swap out some other 80s genre to sort of like pick it up. I'm not sure what that would be. Like, I don't think you could go like from 83 Stranger Things to 84, like a Stranger Things, the Ghostbusters vibe, I guess would be like the appropriate time period, but you could do something different because I'm not completely convinced that the monster here is like has anything to do with like the weird slugs or with why this other dimension, this other parallel dimension exists. If that makes it more or less interesting. I'm not sure if it does. It does for me.
No, I
love,
I mean,
mythologies.
It does. I'm wary of it becoming like Sleepy Hollow or something like that. I think that there is a danger of that. And I'm always wary of anything that's so popular in season one possibly sustaining in season two. I'm really concerned about that. So I think an anthology is almost a better opportunity to start fresh and shake off expectations. You know, Fargo landed that beautifully. True Detective, not so much. So it's not always guaranteed. But I just think it's as much as I love like Millie Bobby Brown and David Harbour and like a lot of the performers in the series, and like it's not like I never want to see them again. I just think that that might help with managing expectations to do something different. But obviously, they're not going to do something different, so never mind.
Well, I mean, I want to stay in this hypothetical for a little bit because I think it would help us define like what it is. So, if they were to do an anthology, is it another early 80s style story? Are they like once again pulling from, you know, the Spielberg movies, from Firestarter, from you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street series, or are they jumping to another time period? Are we suddenly getting like, you know, 60s you know, like I don't know what that would be, hard boiled detective Star Trek series?
Well, I mean, so that's what I think Noah Hawley has done so well, is sort of adapt the Coen vibe for these different time periods on the two seasons of Fargo. I am not confident that the Duffers could do that. I think they're drawing on, you know, they were born the same year as Dave, so they're drawing on the same nostalgia. So I feel like they're knack here is really anchored in that nostalgic experience, and I don't think that they, maybe I'm being unfair and underestimating them, but I don't think they would thrive in a huge genre challenge. I think they need to stay in their wheelhouse. But we could go somewhere else in the world, you know. It could still be the Upside Down, it could still be that monster almost, but I would be interested in going somewhere else in the world, maybe. And doing that instead. And then like in a future season coming back to the kids, not quite it older, but still a little older. I think that would be interesting too. Something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess
like a late, like a late 80s, early 90s, like second season with older kids would totally be in like a similar wheelhouse for somebody in my age group.
Right.
But like you said, it's probably going to be a 84, 85 we're going to deal with.
I think there's a couple interesting things. One, when they, you know, right after the season came out and everybody was starting to ask about this, in one of the interviews they talked about not thinking of it as a series necessarily, but more like an 8-hour movie, and thinking about the next one would be a sequel as opposed to just a direct continuation. So I feel like that seems to indicate that they want to jump forward a little bit. I think there's also the idea that just like we've seen with Game of Thrones, like these kids are going to get a lot older very quickly. So I feel like they're almost going to be forced to jump ahead a few years unless they've already started shooting it. And then I guess the other big question for me, and this goes to the mythology, which is how big or how expansive is the Upside Down? Is the Upside Down something that exists everywhere in the world, or is the Upside Down something that exists in a finite amount of space? Like, it just exists in the metaphysical realm underneath this city, you know? But like, if you go to Indianapolis, is there an Upside Down for Indianapolis, or is it something created by the experiments they were doing in that building, and it only exists so far?
I mean, you know, I have to love that because it's very much like the Hellmouth in Buffy. Like only certain cities have Hellmouths.
Sure.
For me, I mean, I guess it depends how it was created. And I love the idea that it was created by, you know, Matthew Modine or someone else tinkering with science.
It's the Modine magic is what did it.
Yeah. But I felt like it was a skin like right under our entire world, that just like a mirror world under ours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially because there's like the, I mean, I guess that's what the upside down denotes, but, you know, especially in that forest scene we get later on in the season. I mean, the pool scene too. I mean, it's just like, it's just the, on the other side of where you are is where the upside down is. Right. And,
right.
I kind of like the idea of that being everywhere, but if there's only one monster, maybe 95% of the upside down is actually a quite pleasant place to be. And wherever the monster resides sucks.
I think it would be a little disappointing if there really is only one monster, because then what's the point?
Maybe the biggest, threat of Stranger Things is loneliness. Maybe he just wanted friends. Maybe he just wanted Will and Barb to be his friends. And oops, he accidentally ate them or one of them. But really, he just wants friendship.
I also think that. Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, I was going to say, in terms of crazy theory town, what if the tentacle monster is different from like the slug monster and whatnot? But the actual like petal head monster is a human that was there too long.
Oh.
Yeah, or like what happens to Eleven?
Stranger Things season 2, The Return of Barb.
Sure.
As the monster.
Well, I like the idea that the portal was created by like Eleven touching this monster, but then the evil Brenner doesn't seem like too surprised that there was a monster in the weird space, so that this is like not his first experience with the upside down, and that maybe he, you know, had the power to send, you know, 1 through 10 accidentally to this other dimension.
Are you talking Matthew Modine prequel?
Hey, I'm, maybe flashbacks, or there's like, people have slowed down the news article at the end, and there's a quote from Brenner denying the events happened, implying that he could have possibly survived.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yeah. Or, you know, it could also be a deception by the evil government. Who knows?
Modine, more like Mordine. I would love Matthew Modine to come back.
But I like that idea, because then Will is like half monster, so he's producing the little slugs, but he's, you know, his face isn't going to split open anytime soon because they got him out of there in time.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Or he's like pumped full of slugs by the tentacle. Who knows?
Poor kid. He just has to live with it.
Yep.
It's like the worst version of herpes.
It's going to make his dating life very awkward.
Yeah. Hold on. I have to go sneeze up a slug. Also, yes. Where did you go? I guess the big question for me is more of a thematic question, because the one thing that I think it gets right, and this goes beyond the nostalgia, like there's a lot of heavy-handed, like, oh, they have a thing poster and they're talking, you know, all the music of the show is very specific to that year. The other thing they got was this thematic idea that I sort of remember from the 80s, but I think my parents probably remember it a lot better, which is the kind of Reagan era nuclear family idea, where they would run the, you know, do you know where your children are type of thing, commercials in the 80s. And so they got that paranoia. You know, there was this time in the 80s when, you know, kids were beginning to be on their own more, because you had more working families, more working middle class families. And it was this sense of freedom for young kids, but also this sense of parental paranoia that kids would start to go missing, or that the evils of the world were out there. So I think they got that right. So if you do another season, what's the big theme? You know, obviously you can't go back to that well where one of the kids just disappears. So do you anchor it with some kind of theme that fits the time period? Or are we now just so far down the road that you just got to go straight sci-fi, you know, like just go deeper into this world and, you know, have Sheriff Hop or Chief Hop become a Ghostbuster, essentially. So that's the big question for me for season two is where do they anchor the theme? Because I think that's really what brought people back, because that's what a lot of these movies are about. You know, E.T., Close Encounters, Nightmare on Elm Street, those all kind of have that same thematic glue. And I think that's really what gets people into Stranger Things, is it gets that part right, which I thought was very important.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot more to be mined from the actual children as characters, because after a certain point in the story, they just become, you know, 11 forwarding cogs. Maybe most of the story. So I feel like you could, you know, do a riff on, like, you could do some sort of, like, revisiting parts of their past, but just, like, not as far back and still sort of get away with it. Or you could, like, I don't know. It would feel weird to do something like a Monster Squad where just, like, go full out, you know, towards that Ghostbusters feel. Where it's like, well, now there's, you know, three monsters and Eleven has full control over stuff. And Will is like a superhero who could, you know, bounce back and forth. That seems a little off, but I feel like some sort of more character driven horror of the middle 80s. I mean, I really just.
Yeah. And in terms of character driven horror, sorry, I just cut you off.
No. Go ahead.
Well, I think what would be interesting for these kids at this age, as you say, they're going to grow up pretty fast. They're right on the cusp of something. And I know you have like the Nancy generation, like the older teens, but here you've got these kids who are just like almost not kids anymore, you know? And so to do a sort of puberty metaphor, which is a very, very common horror trope, and you have a prime candidate there in Will, and also Eleven sort of figuring out her powers. I think that would be something really interesting, like watching these kids go through the thing, not to like reference Buffy again, but that's like a big Buffy thing, right? Is sort of like watching these growing up feelings manifested through the horror genre, I think would be very interesting. Like, I agree with you, Neil, that a lot of this had to do with like family and panic and, you know, Winona Ryder's panic and David Harbour's loss and all of that sort of stuff. But for these kids to move away from the lost kid position into the teen, self-actualized teen position, I think would be interesting to watch.
Yeah. And yeah. And I think the other thing that they do very well is they anchor Eleven's situation in sort of not actual science per se, but government things that people were paranoid the government was doing around that time, which was basically giving people drugs and experimenting with them to see if they could use them as weapons. So, I think they've got to find that second piece. I don't think they can go more ridiculous for season two. I think they have to continue to keep it grounded, and I think they'll be okay. But they've really painted themselves in an interesting corner.
Yeah, I like Joanna's puberty thing, because then I could sort of like make Will go through like a Close Encounters protagonist thing where he has like this force that he doesn't know that's drawing him there, and the government's like, he's got a upside down force, and then you have like Eleven basically doing carry, and you know, you slam them both together like this one sort of slams together like E.T. and Nightmare on Elm Street and a couple of different things. I'd watch that. Watch the shit out of that.
It's kind of like a Midnight Special, the movie from earlier this year.
Yes, if it could execute the ending slightly better, then I would be down for it almost being exactly Midnight Special.
You mean not just do Tomorrowland again?
I managed to avoid Tomorrowland, so I know not the reference of what you speak.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, like, and I liked the Nancy character. Oh, fine. And there's some creepy weirdness with like the brother being forgiven for being like such a creepy peeping Tom so easily. And
he was just looking for his brother.
Very 80s. Yeah, it's very 80s about that though.
Right? Yeah, no, I agree. But that's 80s politics in a show. It's 80s sexual politics in a show written now. I think one of the interesting things about that a lot of people have picked up on is, you know, that one of the most famous classic horror tropes is that if the young woman loses her virginity in the horror movie, she's going to die, right? It's the virgin who lives. In this instance, they killed the virgin, who's Barb, and they let Nancy live. And a lot of people, some people are saying that that's like a celebration of, you know, women getting to have sex and not be punished for it. Other people are like, what the hell did Barb ever do to you that she had to get punished?
Why did nobody at school hold a memorial for Barb?
Yeah, why did no one give a shit about Barb? What about Barb is the movie that I would like to make. What about Barb starring Bill Murray? What did you guys think, like, consider the sexual politics at all? Is that an interesting topic to you?
Not until just now. And now I'm considering it.
There is Joanna talking about ladies and sex again.
I do think it's interesting. Yeah, I never thought about the virgin thing before, because there, you know what, the trouble, and I've watched Stranger Things twice all the way through now. The trouble is you're doing trope tracking through the whole thing, so there's so much to pull apart. It's like, oh, there's a little bit of Amityville. There's a little bit of Stand By Me. There's another visual cue for E.T. and, you know, there's Close Encounters. So I feel like you really have to, I mean, someone whose brain works slowly like mine has to go through it a couple times to really start to pick out the themes. But it makes sense, I guess.
I mean, I was sort of, what you're talking about, picking out those themes, I guess that's sort of being able to identify them and recognizing the subtext the filmmakers were trying to speak to me emotionally, like feel tense here, feel like this way about this character. Because I was so into getting it and into the plot, I don't think I stopped to be like super critical about it. Case in point, there is some withholding in the midway through this series with the teenage characters, which I'm supposed to hate. And people brought up to me like, I bet Dave hated that part. But I didn't, because I'm like, you know, you're doing this like teen 80s horror movie. That's like a trope you're going to have to hit, is like the stupid withholding because, like, I don't know, consequences about stepdads. So 80s.
My biggest sticking point, and I know I complained to you guys about this a couple weeks ago, is the bullies seem so insanely mean that I don't get it. Like, they're teasing, they tease the boys about Will being dead, their dead friend. Like, that's insane to me. And a lot of people are like, no, that fits right in with 80s movies. And you're probably right. I mean, I've seen Carrie. Like, kids are the worst in these 80s movies. But yeah, both like genre of fake John Ralphio's friends, two friends, and the boys who are tormenting our younger trio are just crazy mean. They're not like anchored in any sort of believability mean. They're just so evil.
They're just assholes.
That's like Stephen King mean child bullies, right? Where it's like you really have the threat, like when the kids think that they might die, like you as like a reader is like, hey, they might, that kid might kill that other kid.
Yeah.
That's the kind of book where this might happen.
Since you brought up mini John Ralphio, can we talk about my, or it's both mine and the internet's, many theories about how these things connect to other things?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so there's some theories that, one that I came up with. First of all, the girl who plays the sister, what's her name again? Nancy?
Nancy, yeah.
She's basically little Karen Allen. So the theory goes like this, that she is you know, maybe like the granddaughter, because the timing kind of works out a little bit, of maybe like an Indiana Jones and Marion Ravenwood type of couple. And then she eventually marries little John Ralphio and ends up, and he ends up being John Ralphio's dad from Parks and Rec.
Yes. Yes. No, I love this game. And then you have to like connect it all the way back to Sherlock Holmes and you're done.
Right. So you, if you're going to go down this pop culture aping pastiche thing, you might as well just keep going with the correct platitude and be like, well, obviously Nancy, like, so Nancy and Mike's mom is the daughter of Indiana Jones and Marion Ravenwood.
So
got trapped in a loveless marriage.
Right. Got trapped in a loveless marriage working at a university in the Midwest.
Yeah, just like the generation that had no excitement, and then like the excitement skips generations.
Yeah.
So how is Winona Ryder in Stranger Things related to young Winona Ryder who's running around pop culture in the 80s? Concurrently, like Winona Ryder from Lucas. Is this like a niece? Winona Ryder from Lucas is a niece of Winona Ryder in Stranger Things.
Yeah, like Winona Ryder in Stranger Things is like the crazy aunt.
Yeah.
Who didn't, you know, she's one of like six kids that all have similar features, and she's the one who just kind of ended up dating the wrong guy and ended up working the bad job and leading the not so exciting life until her kid gets swallowed up by a, you know, other dimension.
Man, the way you watch TV is better than the way I watch TV.
It's too much. Like, it's the whole puzzle piece thing.
Is that wig on 11 actually the wig from E.T.? Like, it's literally the same wig.
Oh my God. Like, if you assume that these all go together, like, what if that monster is really somehow related to the monster in Super 8? Because they kind of have similar things. So, like, what if...
I don't know if Super 8 has earned the...
That's true.
So here's my question, Dave. What about, you know, Super 8 got burned by a lot of people for being exactly what some people accuse Stranger Things of, which is an empty, cheap 80s nostalgia knockoff, Spielberg knockoff. What does Stranger Things have that Super 8 didn't for you? To the point where like Kyle Chandler's character and David Harbour's character, people like connect those two, you know, Elle Fanning and Eleven to a certain degree, you know, people are drawing like really strong parallels between these two properties. I agree with you. I didn't think Super 8 was a great thing, but I'm wondering. Yeah, that's just me. I'm just going to reiterate my question.
Yeah, I think that Super 8 wasn't able to... it didn't deal with time as well as you'd like it to, just because it kind of looked new and the like lens flares and like the fact that these kids were like into making movies at a time where I feel like you have to be like a really esoteric kid to like have a film camera and be like setting up these things. Like I feel like that happened to like the VHS generation, but it's like was slightly off at creating wonder that it felt manufactured. And Stranger Things may not create a lot of its own wonder, but it does know how to string together its references in the, you know, correct alchemy to have me flowing along with it and not being like, don't withhold information, you asshole. Just, but like, hey, that's, you know, the E.T. shot and like, why? I don't know why, you know, summer nights are misty in the 80s, but they were, and that feels completely right. And like that shot through that window feels right. And that all, it just felt right, where Super 8 felt like it was trying to get there, but like outside of small moments where, you know, someone would do the Spielberg look and you'd be like, yes, I'm supposed to be feeling wonder now. You would just notice the Spielberg look. And for me, it didn't generate the actual wonder.
I think they're both good examples of, you know, I think this is ultimately going to speak to the brilliance of Steven Spielberg, because he could accomplish this in a movie runtime, but also he was kind of doing it in the period that he was setting his movies, which was probably very important. But Stranger Things, you know, Super 8 feels like it always is one step short of getting to those kind of magical moments, and it feels like it's a little short thematically, whereas Stranger Things has more time to build it out over the course of 8 episodes. So I think that's a big thing. Also, there really is an earnestness about the way the Duffer Brothers put together Stranger Things that they probably went to over and beyond lengths to make this feel like a natural lived-in world with characters who have all these, you know, different histories and all these histories tie together, like the chief of police who there's the story about his daughter. Whereas Super 8 was just trying to plow through all these moments that J.J. Abrams wanted to throw lens flares
at. Oh, I want to revise my answer to make it simpler. I think both creative teams made their childhood, and I didn't recognize myself in J.J. Abrams' childhood.
Right. Ooh, okay. Yeah, and I think you're right, Neil, that, you know, for all my gentle critiques that I have of Stranger Things, I would not accuse it of being cynical or like, you know, it's not like they tried to cook up this 80s nostalgia stew in a lab to, you know, make older millennials fall for it. Like, I don't feel that way at all. I do think they were very earnest in making this. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right as well that the nature of a TV series allows room that Super 8 never could have had. And then Dave is right that Super 8 looked too shiny and the edges too sharp. And we needed a little more fuzz.
Super right.
I do. Everyone's right.
Well, the lack of cynicism or the earnestness, I think, is what it really ties together a lot of the good nostalgia that we're seeing. You know, and we've talked about Stranger Things. The other thing that Joanna and I saw was Pete's Dragon, which
I loved.
If there is an overwhelming thing about Pete's Dragon that is good, it is its lack of cynicism. It's this uncynical adaptation of this children's book or this children's movie that a lot of us experience as an animated movie or mostly animated movie, right?
Well, the dragon's animated. The rest is live action.
So
yeah.
It's this earnestness of, and it's funny. I saw Pete's Dragon yesterday, and we talked about, last week on the show, we talked about deconstruction in regard to the DC universe and the way certain filmmakers are able to deconstruct a character and figure out what their stories are really about, even though it's an existing property.
Yeah.
And the way that the director, whose name I'm losing, David Lowery, yes.
Yeah.
The way that he and his writing team and the creative team around Pete's Dragon kind of deconstructed the original story and broke it down to basically be a boy and his dog is insanely good and makes this a beautiful story.
On behalf of cat people everywhere, I do want to say that David Lowery's actually based Pete or Elliot the dragon on his cat.
Oh my god, seriously?
Yeah. Which I totally saw in the way that dragon was animated. I guess dogs chase their tails too, but there's a part where Elliot's chasing his tail that I was just like, that's pure cat. So boy and his dog, or boy and
there
his cat.
Goes Joanna.
Boy and a boy and his beloved pet. Joanna loves cats. It's okay.
Cats and social justice.
But the other thing I want to say about Pete's Dragon, which really is just like one of the most beautiful films that I saw this year, pretty simple and pretty, but not at all like lesser for being so simple. The thing that I want to talk about in terms of Stranger Things is the time period, and it is set very obviously in either the late 70s or early 80s, is the least forced period piece I think I've ever seen. Because it's like, there's some question, you know, I think we talked about in Fighting the War Room about like, is it a film actually, is it a period film or is it just a film out of time? But I mean, the cars all give it a period piece film, but you don't get like huge blaring hits from the year on the soundtrack. The soundtrack is actually like modern music that's, you know, folksied up, but it's like, it's modern music. So like, for the most part, So it just was a gentler time sort of thing. And there are no cell phones. the clothes look 70s-ish. But other than that, it's just like so warm, this warm, gentle throwback. I loved Pete's Dragon so much. It felt like my childhood came out to hug me. And there's a lot of tearful hugging in that movie. But it just really does do. It's a really interesting thing, I think, to compare to Stranger Things, because despite the fact that it's a remake, it's so divorced from leaning on other stories. It just so feels very much its own story about this young boy and this lost dragon and these town folk. And I'm really in awe of all of it. I'm crushed that it's not doing better at the box office, but I really hope that it becomes one of those growing at home as you show it to children kind of classic movies. I really hope so.
Yeah, I think there's a possibility that Pete's Dragon might have legs. We'll see. It's been a weird August, but I don't think not crushing it is atypical at this time of year for that type of movie. If it could hold on through a little bit of horror and some prestige, it could have some legs for a while, hopefully.
Well, I mean, I totally respect your decision not to see it because of your family dog passing away. But I am really interested to hear what you think eventually of the CG, because I thought it was incredible. Ooh. And you know I hate CG. and we talk about CG dragons a lot when we're in Game of Thrones mode. So, you know, anyway. Yes, Neil.
I had a very specific thought along those lines, specifically about Dave while watching it. And this is something that I think is kind of universal. We're going to talk about Kubo next week and the work of Laika. But there is this notion that when you're animating, there's always the uncanny valley, which a lot of people, when you look at a character, are they too real? Are they not real enough? Are they in that weird space? And I think that in the history of CG animation, especially mixing with live action, the best stuff gets the eyes right.
Yeah.
And I was struck by Pete's Dragon for numerous reasons. One, they get the dragon's eyes right, like the emotion that you can see kind of flowing from the dragon. The other thing is they got actors in Bryce Dallas Howard, Robert Redford, Carl Urban that have these expressive faces, that have these expressive eyes on their own. And the two kids are great with this too. I feel like this is a movie where you can go, and if you're paying close attention to it, you can see that there's a lot of close-up shots where a lot of the story is being told through the eyes of different characters. And I think that is just wonderful. And that's another thing I'd like to get Dave's take on eventually, which is how they really make it feel seamless between the eyes of this completely fictional dragon and these humans, and they give very similar performances. I think that's one of the more wonderful things about it.
Also interested. Oh, I'm sorry.
I see the passive shade you just gave to Wes Bentley by omitting him from the list.
No.
Wes Bentley is in this movie. He definitely is in this movie. That's about all I can say for Wes Bentley in this.
Isaiah Whitlock Jr. is in this movie and at no point says she.
But he does with like his face. There's definitely one shot where I was like, oh my God, he's gonna say it. He's gonna say it right now, and he doesn't. He's so great. We were just talking about the sort of the Spielberg gaze, the gaze of wonder. And I think you definitely see that, you know, a bit with Elliot, but then later with Robert Redford, Bryce Dallas Howard, and the young girl in the film, even Carl Urban. Like, it's pretty incredible that the design of that creature, who's a fur covered dragon, which is a controversial and interesting choice. But what it means is that you can get these great close up shots of like Elliot snuggling a leg. And it's obviously like a, you know, puppet covered in fur. And so you don't get that weirdness. You just get, you know, he's snuggling something that's fur covered, and it looks great.
It's not Amelia Clark looking at a tennis ball.
Right, exactly. Or there's also a great effect, and I don't think this is a spoiler, even though this is Storm of Spoilers, so I can talk about it, but, you know, Elliot, the dragon, vanishes a lot. And that was true of the original film. And so you get this great, distortion effect as Pete walks through the forest, invisible, but visible. It's really great. I'm amazed at how low the budget was on this film and actually how quickly they were able to complete it. Because, you know, Jungle Book obviously is far more ambitious, but Jungle Book took, like, I don't know, 50 years. I think Jon Favreau was negative 20 when he started that movie. But David Lowery did this, I think, in just like 2 years, something like that. Like, I'm, right. I'm just
and
really
they made
impressed
it for
with
like
it,
$65 million.
Yeah,
Jungle Book was
so cheap,
like 3 times that.
Exactly.
But I do think that when we're talking about nostalgia and we're talking about creating a world that feels like your childhood that you can identify with, sometimes those are the simplest things, like using the Spielberg gaze and creating these moments that feel familiar, even though you're watching something new. That's what it's about. You know, when we talk about the difference between like something like this or Stranger Things versus the ones that don't work, like Super 8, it's about this kind of heartfelt earnestness of creating those moments or kind of recreating that feeling instead of just recreating that visual, like the frame, which is what J.J. Abrams is able to do. Is he can recreate a frame perfectly, but can you recreate that feeling? And I think that he's there. He was there with Star Wars much better than he was with Super 8. But I think that you do see a lot of nostalgia, basically nostalgia porn that doesn't get it right. You know, I mean, we talked about this. I hate that I have to keep coming back to the DC cinematic universe. We talked about this essentially with Batman versus Superman, which is they're creating panels that look like the comic books that people read in the 1980s, but they're not created. They're not understanding the character and the story and everything that made those panels special. This movie and this show understand what they're essentially adapting. So I would call them, instead of remakes or homages, they really are adaptations of previous material.
I mean, I think that's certainly true of Peace Dragon, and I could probably get there with Stranger Things, but Peace Dragon reminds me of something that Dave loves to talk about. Dave, we're just like basically really dying for you to see this movie, but, you know, with Hannibal or Fargo, it's this notion of an adaptation that's as far away from the source material as possible, but somehow more true than a more Slavish adaptation would be because, it gets the heart of it, right? The tone of it rather than the beat by beat storyline of it. And whenever you watch a Disney film or a Marvel film or a Lucas film, or a DC film, you have to think about the merchandising angle that goes with these properties, right? Because these studios see a huge amount of profit, not just from the film itself, but from the merchandising angle. And one of the highest praises I can give Peace Dragon is I know they designed that dragon specifically so that they could sell plushy dragons to children to snuggle. But somewhere between the first Tearful Hug, which is about like 2 minutes into the movie, 5 minutes into the movie, and the last Tearful Hug, which is right at the end of the movie, and there's a bunch in between, I like didn't care. I like all my cynical marketing. I know why Elliot looks like he does, because they can sell plushies. I didn't care. I was all in on that dragon. I want an Elliot plushie is what I'm saying. So
Peace successfully dragon. Marketed.
Yes.
And I think that's the benefit of doing nostalgia well, is if you do it well, it also transfers to people who might not know what you're referencing. So we could all dig into Pete's Dragon and Stranger Things, but I think they also, you know, because they're nostalgia done well, people who have no idea what it is at least have something to hook onto. Or that's the hope, at least with Pete's Dragon. I've seen it happen with some younger people with Stranger Things, so I definitely know it's happening there. But way to bring it all the way back to adaptation, guys, after I started this off saying it wasn't. It's great. Well, it's like a whole podcast that we planned out, even though that is completely the opposite of what happened.
Can we talk about one last thing that Neil and I definitely studied for this podcast before we go, which is Paper Girls, which is a comic book by Brian K. Vaughan. I can't remember, Dave, if you read Paper Girls.
I have not.
Okay. So this is from Brian K. Vaughan, who's behind Saga and Why the Last Man. He's considered one of the geniuses of comics right now. And it's an 80s set sci-fi story about four tough as nails paper girls and their adventures on one Halloween night. And there are, I guess I can't, well, a storm of spoilers, right? I can talk about it. You know, at first you think it's aliens that are the menace, to their, I guess it's not a night. It's got to be like pre-dawn because they're paper girls. At first you think it's aliens and then it looks like it's time travelers. And there's all these great like, what? Time travel cliffhangers. And they've introduced like a future speak, which is, I usually really hate sort of like pigeon patois of like how our language is going to evolve. See Cloud Atlas for your reference there. But I actually really love the one that they've invented for this comic. And it's just, it's been a big hit. I don't know if it's been a big commercial hit, but it's a huge critical hit. It's on all the lists of like the best comic, new comic of 2016 and that sort of thing. And, you could buy the first volume if you want to. I had trouble getting through the first issue. I didn't really hook into these girls right away. But they've got the sneakers and the bikes and the jeans jacket and everything that you would expect from the Stranger Things kids. They're a little older, and one of them smokes. But as the story goes on, I got more and more into it, and I'm a fan. Neil, what do you think?
I'm also a fan. I think it's another example of an earnest adaptation of a time. And the other thing is that it does the Brian K. Vaughan thing, which I love, which is something that I think he did very well with Lost when he was there for those few seasons. That Why the Last Man does, which is basically the reverse funnel, which is he starts off with a very small scope. You know, it's basically about a paper route and it's about bullies. And then a mysterious thing happens. And the world expands, and it just keeps expanding. And I think that's what kept me hooked on Why the Last Man for so long, is like, where the hell is this, like, going? You know, you just want to keep exploring this world. So I think Paper Girls, I think I'm through the first six issues, and it gets weird and dark and very twisty and turny, but not in a forced way. Like it feels like you are the fifth girl and you're riding alongside them, and you continue to discover that, like, what the hell is everyone else reacting to? You know, whereas like they just thought, you know, it's basically about like these girls get like mugged by these mysterious dudes and they're like going to go beat their ass. And it just unravels into this crazy world. And I think that's it. It also has that very 80s thing of the small town. I mean, it's set right outside Cleveland in a fake city, but in my heart, it's in my own hometown. it kind of looks like my hometown too, which is pretty great. But this whole weird thing happening in a random Midwestern town, which is always going to get me. So. Yes, I liked it. I like it very much. I can't wait to keep reading it.
Yeah. Someone I follow on Twitter, I think it was the woman who writes under the name DC Women Kicking Ass. Like she has a site called DC Women Kicking Ass. And she said that she had wished Stranger Things had been about girls, like Paper Girls was. I think between 11, Nancy and Winona Ryder, like there's a good female representation.
Oh, you don't get any of sister, the little sister who's like the background all star.
Oh yeah, yeah. She has that great like discovery scene, right? But it is fun to see. I mean, I read a lot of comics that are just really pushing on what we expect from a protagonist. And so in Paper Girls, you've got four girls, you know, one of them is basically a juvenile delinquent. Two of them are definitely not white. And you just, you know, they're just not girls you get to see in film or television yet. And I feel like we get to see them in comics, which is a joy. And, you know, Brian K. Vaughan is so great with that, in Saga as well. Just casual diversity that, and representation, which, as you know, as a social justice warrior means a lot to me. So, but more than anything else, it's a really good story.
You know
so
what it is, though? It's funny that people call it social justice warriors, but when you say stuff like, you know, these are characters you don't see in these kind of stories in comics and TV and movies. My brain instantly goes to, yeah, but it's like these are people that I've met in my life.
Yeah.
Which I think is the more important thing. It's not about like social justice. It's like you kind of want your stories to be anchored in if they're going to be a reflection of your childhood, which is something we talked about earlier in the show. You kind of want it to reflect the experience that you have growing up in the suburbs. You know, like I knew all kinds of different people, you know, growing up outside of Cleveland. So this Paper Girls feels really natural to me because each one of these girls, while she kind of fits into a different type, an archetype, I guess, these are all people that I had it, you know, in my middle school. So that's what makes it more resonant.
It's cool. Paper Girls, check it out. Pete's Dragon. Here's how I would rank what you should check out in order of Pete's Dragon because it needs it more. Stranger Things and then Paper Girls. But if you listen to this, hopefully you've read or watched all those things already. Right.
And all of them cost you. It's like $10 or $12 to like get all of Paper Girls or 1 month of Netflix or a ticket to Pete's Dragon.
That's how much it costs to get in a time travel machine and possibly relive your 80s childhood.
And then you'll want to go home and hug whatever pet you have after Pete's Dragon.
You guys, I did hug my cat. Okay, so it happened.
Well, I can't do that. Thanks a lot,
guys. Oh, no.
Perfect. I was almost over it. Now, never again.
You can hug
Joanna.
Drama.
Do you want to briefly address how hesitant you are about the new It while we're in this sort of pocket?
Oh, yeah. I guess well, here's the issue. I never watched the original It or read the book. So feel free to tell me to bugger off my opinions. But I feel like It is being treated like this huge film event that we should all be looking forward to with you know, dramatic costume photo reveals on Entertainment Weekly and stuff like that. And I just don't care. And, you know, maybe I sound like an asshole because I just have no connection to it. But if you watched It as a kid and Tim Curry haunted your dreams forever, maybe you do very much care what the new Pennywise looks like. The original film, two-part film, was conceived by Cary Fukunaga, who is a great director, did Jane Eyre and did True Detective Season 1 and Beast of No Nation. He was then sort of fired off or pushed off or whatever, conflicting reports, because he and New Line, the studio, could not reconcile budgets.
Well, he wanted to do two movies.
They're
right?
Still doing two movies, I believe. So
there was a time period where they were arguing about that and trying to get it condensed, and I think that's when Fukunaga was like, "Fuck,
I'm out, I'm out." He was like, "I will not compromise my creative vision." And bravo for that. But then the project's still moving along. It's his script. It's been rewritten, but it's still his script that they're moving forward with, which just makes me feel really weird. The new director, Dave. What's the name of the new director?
It's Andy Muschietti of Mama fame.
Mama. So probably going to get a little bit more straight. I liked Mama, but we're still probably going to get more straightforward horror than we would necessarily from Cary Fukunaga. And I'm just not...
I wouldn't be sure about that.
Okay.
So, like, I went to the Mama set when I was back in my film journalism days. and the machetes are him and I believe it's his sister are really interesting creative people, and at least for that movie I could see why it would be interesting to bring him in to do someone else's adaptation of it, because for that movie there was like an outline and a story, but at least for him it was about images, so he had the moths, he had the movement and the, you know, story of Mama, you know, he had the mythology, and then the story sort of like incidentally came together the way it did. So it's going to be interesting to see him. We've already seen he has a different view for Pennywise, and it's not getting a lot of props on the internet, but it's definitely something that I'm like, that's something that Andy just drew and decided that's the way it was going to look. And now he's going to follow that through with a big budget movie. So,
well, maybe. I mean, do you know?
Well,
that?
The hope is that, like, when we're talking about stuff like Suicide Squad, sorry, Neil, bringing it up again, where we're like, you know, at least if you're going to have a vision, you know, commit to that vision and fail wholeheartedly, I think that's the worst case scenario for it, which at least is exciting to watch. For me, as somebody who kind of enjoyed the TV version,
I think what's going to be endlessly distracting for me is the just this idea of ownership, who owns what, you know, which was a bit distracting when Ant-Man came out. I loved Ant-Man, but like I was always like, what was Edgar Wright's idea and what wasn't, and like what should we be giving him credit for and what shouldn't we? And with this, you know, the idea to cast a young handsome actor as Pennywise was Cary Fukunaga's idea. You know, so instead of Tim Curry, we get Alexander Skarsgård's handsome brother. Before that, it was Will Poulter under Cary Fukunaga's direction. And so the character design maybe is Andy's drawing, or maybe it's left over from Cary's reign. Like, we don't know. And so then I get, then I can tie it even back to Game of Thrones, where I get like protective of authors. Like, what did Cary Fukunaga conceive that he had to let go of because of his deal with New Line? Probably to leave a lot of his intellectual property on the table because of his deal and his artistic integrity. And now I feel weird about the whole thing, I guess, because I don't know what was his. And I don't know why that troubles me, but it does.
I have a feeling we might be revisiting this because yeah. There's a
do
lot
Do I
of...
have to read it? Oh my God.
Well, I mean,
so
I'm asking
scared.
The same question. I looked at maybe buying a physical copy this weekend and was intimidated out of the bookstore downtown. Thank God there are Pokemon on the street.
Intimidated by who? Bookstore bullies?
You know, the size of it. I like picked it up, but I'm like, this is only $15, but I feel like it's that much worth of paper. Just like,
oh man, we're gonna have to do an It episode, aren't we?
My first exposure.
We have Dark Tower.
My first exposure to it came from like I think my second grade teacher told me she read it. And that she couldn't sleep. She thought that there were like murderous clowns under every bed. And I didn't even read it. And I started to think there were murderous clowns under every bed. So this is going to be some like weird, deeply rooted trauma revisiting for me if we end up reading it. So
I have a take on this movie.
I'm ready.
Are interested.
Of course I am.
One, we have a year. So I think we can all get the book read by then and get over our nightmares, because it doesn't come out till September of next year. Two things. One, they actually have done a very good job of casting the kids. Finn Wolfhard, who plays Mike in Stranger Things, is in this movie. He plays Richie, the kind of the main kid. And the kid from Midnight Special, Jaden Lieberher, is also in it. So good kid actors is a good start, especially for something that you're essentially readapting. Here's the question as we move forward with it. In recent years, probably over the last 10, 15 years, we've seen a lot of these remakes, these beloved horror franchise remakes. And first of all, there were no campaigns to shut down Rotten Tomatoes when Friday the 13th got nailed. second of all, but here, the thing that we've seen with the trend with like the new Freddy Krueger, which was played by Jackie Earle Haley, the new Jason Voorhees, every single one of them shares in the fact that they are kind of a more, I like to call it a more metal version. Like, it's the harder, more cynical, real post 9/11 version of these characters where it's got to amp up all of the things that made them scary. So when I look at this,
danger's not in Russia, danger's everywhere, motherfuckers.
Right. So when I look at this, when I look at this version of Pennywise, I'm like, oh, that just fits with that same trend where it's like, here's the scarier, gnarlier, more realistic, more sadistic version of a character that was already pretty fucking scary. So I'm curious to see what kind of tone they strike, because those other movies were fairly effective, but they didn't feel original. It just felt like, oh my God, this is obviously the post 9/11 version of this 80s, you know, horror movie. So I'm curious to see where they land on that. The first trailer, I think, will give us a pretty good idea. Whenever we see that, I would imagine we'll see that in the next couple months.
Maybe, or they might wait. Or I would guess February horror dump month.
Yeah.
Or they wait until the summer if they really are, if they're really liking what they see. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. I'm sure, like I said, we'll be back in Stephen King land for a future episode. But until then, Neil, where are we going next week?
Ooh, next week's going to be fun. I already have an idea of how we're going to tie it into adaptation, because we are exploring the magical worlds of Laika, the animation studio that brings us this week Kubo and the Two Strings, and previously movies like Coraline and the Box Trolls. And we're going to be talking about, you know, this week we talked about adaptation of a time period. There is an element to Laika where there is a cultural adaptation, where their movies fit into these kind of interesting cultural boxes, where they're taking cultures like Kubo is a very Japanese story, or the Box Trolls has this very interesting Scandinavian European bent. And I think that's one of the things we'll talk about, which I find fascinating. We're also just obviously going to talk about craftsmanship with Laika, because they make stop motion animated movies, which are things that we don't see anymore unless it's from them.
Right.
And
so your homework, for next week, right, is to watch Coraline, Box Trolls, and Kubo, right?
And Kubo. Maybe Paranorman.
I like all those.
Yeah, Paranorman. That's another one, right?
Oh, yes. God, how can I forget Paranorman? That might be my favorite. I mean, I haven't seen Kubo yet, but right now Paranorman's towards the preview of next week. Coraline, not as good as everybody remembers it being.
Oh. I just rewatched it. It's so scary.
It's so good.
But, you know, my Neil Gaiman love will carry me through that. So, yeah, Laika next week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, preview of Dave's weird Neil Gaiman chip on his shoulder. in terms of adapting weird lesser things. But like I said, next week, when you should come back and join us for a Stormworm Spoilers off-season tour. Until then, where can people find more of our work? Let's let Joanna start this week, since I was so mean to her at the beginning.
You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, or you can find me on VanityFair.com, or you can listen to us talk about other pop culture things on Fighting in the War Room, Little Gold Men. These are the podcasts where you can hear my voice.
Neil?
You can hear me on this show. That's where I'm at. You can also read my writing, filmschoolrejects.com. Follow me at Rejects, and don't forget to follow the show at Storm of Spoilers, where we tweet out the things that we write.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You could find me blogging at geek.com, and you could find other podcasts I'm on at fightinginthewarroom.com, including back episodes of this, things that are actually relevant to Game of Thrones. We got some really nice emails of some people who have gone through our back episodes and still find them enjoyable, even though there are places we were obviously way too crazy for our own britches. But until next week, I don't even know what the sound of these two strings being plucked is, but here it comes.